outrageous, impossible-to-believe acts that it was hard to discount even the most outlandish tales. For a man who had funded his own military protection force in Somalia and pursued drone submarines for shipping meth, nothing was really off the table. The fate of TrueCrypt, the disk encryption software that had been built partly on LaRue's code, only added to the intrigue surrounding him. TrueCrypt had been created by anonymous programmers back in 2004, based largely on LaRue's first foray into encryption, E4M. Over the next decade, as TrueCrypt became one of the most widely used programs for securing digital secrets, the people behind it remained anonymous. Whether LaRue had any hand in it, no one seemed to know. At the very least, he had confidence in the software. Former members of LaRue's organization told me that he'd often required them to use TrueCrypt to protect the company's secrets. LaRue's confidence was validated in 2013, when Edward Snowden escaped the United States with a trove of National Security Agency documents, some of which revealed that the NSA had tried and failed to break TrueCrypt. But a year later, the mystery around the software deepened further, when the anonymous developers behind it suddenly announced on their website that the technology could no longer be trusted. Warning: using TrueCrypt is not secure as it may contain unfixed security issues, the announcement read. The encryption community flew into a frenzy of speculation and concern. Had the developers found out that the NSA had finally compromised the program? And were they alerting users to that fact without explicitly saying so? One encryption message board community concluded that the first letters of each word in the announcement, combined and converted from Latin, spelled out the warning, "Don't use TrueCrypt because it is under control of the NSA." Or had they just gotten bored of fixing the program for free? The timing of the announcement raised the possibility that LaRue's arrest had prompted the TrueCrypt shutdown, either because he himself had been working on the software or because his disappearance had spooked those who were. What we did think was that one of the reasons they shut down was that they might be under some sort of pressure. Matthew Green, a computer science professor at the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute, who had studied TrueCrypt, told me in 2015. It's possible that could connect with him being in custody. LaRue, for his part, would only admit in his testimony to having created E4M. 3 years later, someone in contact with LaRue while he was in custody told me that LaRue had boasted privately of launching TrueCrypt himself. LaRue claimed he'd kept his involvement secret and then handed the software off to others, but had funded TrueCrypt's continued development over the years. LaRue also told this source that after his arrest, he had taken advantage of the leeway granted by his DEA handlers to operate freely online and signaled to TrueCrypt's developers that he was in prison. Whether they abandoned the software because of LaRue's warning or because his funding dried up, the source didn't know. "It was his baby," this person said. "I still don't understand why he publicly won't take credit for it." The most persistent hush-hush story around LaRue, in my years of reporting, was that he'd once worked for the U.S. government. Rumors swirled that he or Dave Smith, or both, had ties to the CIA or NSA or FBI. Lachlan McConnell told me that LaRue had once claimed to have worked for the NSA as a computer analyst. I thought, that must be horseshit, McConnell added. But many of the defense attorneys working on LaRue-related cases also quietly wondered if there was a larger issue behind all the secrecy, something more than just LaRue's cooperation. "I always assumed that somehow he was maybe a fucking front company for the CIA," said Marcus, LaRue's South African hitman. "They just did too much shit and got away with it." I gathered up a scattering of tantalizing clues that LaRue had deeper American connections. There was his relationship to Ari Ben-Menashe, the former Israeli spy who claimed to have heard from the Zimbabwean government that LaRue was somehow an American agent. Ben-Menashe's home in Montreal was firebombed in late 2012, much in the manner that Matthew Smith's had been in Bulawayo 3 years earlier. No one was hurt, and the perpetrators were never caught. There were cryptic claims by LaRue to Felix Claussen about having access to U.S. policy decisions in Somalia. There were his 6 months in Virginia in the 1990s. And there was just the overall suspicion that, with the number of countries and variety of endeavors LaRue was involved in, he was bound to have been a useful source to someone, at some point, about something. After searching fruitlessly for confirmation, I eventually just asked Kent Bailey flat out whether there was any truth to rumors that LaRue had U.S. intelligence connections. Bailey was in a reasonable position to know, or at least speculate, and I felt he'd been straight with me about everything else. "That's all bullshit," he said. "That was one of the things we thought of too, and we reached out to see if he was one of their assets. If he is truly working for the CIA, they are never going to admit it. but they would do a better job shielding him, I'm confident. By late 2017, there was one LaRue-related case left, one opportunity for me to hear him tell his own story. That October, prosecutors in the Southern District of New York added Joseph Hunter to the indictment for the murder of Catherine Lee, alongside Adam Simia and David Stilwell. LaRue himself was named as a potential witness in the case, which made sense, given that he'd admitted to ordering the killing. I heard from several sources that LaRue was still cooperating with SOD, providing new targets for them to chase from his old Rolodex, all of which meant he was still potentially months, if not years, away from sentencing. He remained unlisted in the Bureau of Prisons database that tracks federal detainees. Unsurprisingly, the former LaRue employees who had been convicted and sent to prison were mystified that the boss they once feared was now on the other side. One afternoon, I drove out to Pennsylvania to see Scott Stammers, one of the men convicted of the North Korean meth case, at the minimum security federal prison where he was to be housed for the next 15 years. The warden had approved the interview on a non-visitation day, and Stammers was waiting for me in a sunny corner of the empty visitation room in his khaki prison jumpsuit. He said that most of what he knew he couldn't afford to tell me. "There's stuff that I can't talk about because of the safety of my family and the possibility of new charges," he said. "I'm not a saint, but I'm not a bloodthirsty monster shipping drugs around the world." The most important thing he wanted me to know was that, unlike LaRue, he had turned down offers to reduce his time in exchange for informing on others. "I can't believe the deal they gave him," he said. "He's a very intelligent man, very calculated, merciless. He doesn't care. He once told us that we were all monkeys. But I always thought he wanted to be one of us. He wanted to jump out of helicopters, and that's why he surrounded himself with all of us. He didn't care about life, I'll tell you that. In my opinion, it meant nothing to him to have someone killed. He demanded loyalty, and then he turned into a coward. He couldn't do his own time." Other convicted LaRue employees, when they agreed to talk to me, sounded almost wistful about their time working for him. "I always considered it a very unique lifestyle that not anyone could slide into," Tim Benvakias wrote me via email. "For me personally, it felt like a life of Indiana Jones, Jason Bourne, and James Bond all wrapped up in one. You never knew what was coming next." Benvakias was serving a 20-year sentence on murder conspiracy charges in Big Spring, a maximum security facility in Texas. After I succeeded in getting a visit approved, he suddenly wrote and apologized that he could no longer talk to me. "Unfortunately, I'm against the wall at the moment due to other factors," he said vaguely. A few months later, in a document the government filed mistakenly and quickly withdrew, I discovered that he had flipped and would testify against Hunter in his murder trial. Benvakias's name then disappeared from the Bureau of Prisons system. Benvakias had suggested I try to find Chris DeMeyer, who'd worked closely with Hunter for years. "If you could get a hold of him, then I'm sure he could tie up a lot of loose ends," he wrote, "but you'd most definitely have to earn his trust." From what sources told me, DeMeyer had quit the organization around 2011 and moved back to Europe. He hadn't been charged in any of the LaRue-related cases, although his name had surfaced in LaRue's attorney's letter to the judge in Minneapolis, claiming that DeMeyer was a threat to LaRue's family. He'd shown up in the Noemi Edelor murder case file in the Philippines, which named DeMeyer as a suspect, along with Daddy Mac. The former 960 agent told me that the DEA could never identify Daddy Mac, although they suspected he was an American of Samoan descent and lacked the jurisdiction to go after DeMeyer. In late 2017, I finally found DeMeyer on Facebook and sent him a message asking if he would talk about his work for LaRue. "Must be an error, as I know nobody with this name," he responded. "You must have the wrong guy." I pointed out that he was Facebook friends with people who had worked for LaRue, and that he'd posted photos of himself in Subic Bay, in the Philippines, all of which seemed like an enormous coincidence. He had first maintained that he'd only once been a bartender in Subic. When I laid out more of what I knew, he finally relented. "Who exactly did you speak to?" he said. "If you know everything, sir, about me, well then you know everything. It's a can of worms best kept closed." I told him that I couldn't tell him who I'd talked to. "Some people are afraid you'll kill them," I wrote. "I'm not saying you would, just that's what they're afraid of." "Sorry, sir, but I cannot say any more," he replied. "Please be careful in your inquiries, and no, I won't kill you. It's free and well-meant from the heart advice." After a few more exchanges, though, he couldn't seem to resist. "Felix Clausen," he told me, "was the one who snitched on everyone. He played everything," DeMeyer wrote, "and got LaRue done." Then he reiterated that he couldn't tell me anything. "The only thing I ask is not to use stories that are not 100 confirmed," he wrote. Don't listen to druggies and alcoholics with bar stories. They know fuck all. Want the story? Interview Hunter and the boys. If you can reach them. The rest knows fuck all. That's all, sir. I already said too much. I'm in danger just by talking to you, he concluded. By the way, I never killed for LaRue or Hunter. That's why I'm not in prison. The email arrived in my inbox on a Thursday morning at the end of March. The correspondent was an obvious pseudonym, Dirk Van Ho. Subject line, interesting info on PCL. It appeared at first to be similar to random emails I'd received about LaRue over the years, but it soon became clear that this one was different. Hi, Evan, it read. Could you please send me a secure email address, as we need to talk, I believe. I can say that I am your missing link in the Paul Calder LaRue story. The one with the true answers on the downfall of LaRue. He was, he said, the man who had lured LaRue to Liberia. What motivated him to contact me seemed to be a mix of anger over the Minnesota acquittals and a gap he'd seen in my articles on LaRue. Most of your story is correct and accurate, and as someone who lived the life and work with PCL, I have to say respect, he wrote. But to make it complete and perfect, you could for sure use my input and evidence. We switched to encrypted email, and he forwarded me documents to validate his information. He told me he'd run the operation in Somalia and then unlocked LaRue for the DEA. Then, at the end of the note, he signed off with his real name. I'd long suspected that this man was the 960 Group informant, based on fragments of information that I'd swept up over the years. But I'd never been able to locate him or uncover any real proof. So thoroughly had the DEA kept his name out of the public case that I had seen it only twice in all the tens of thousands of pages of documents I had on LaRue. I exchanged emails with this man, whom I've referred to as Felix Clausen, the use of a pseudonym was the sole condition I agreed to before he would talk, for several months, as he offered me tantalizing pieces of his story, and I tried to coax him into meeting me in person. Since LaRue's arrest, he said, he had become a kind of professional informant for hire, infiltrating other criminal groups and reporting back to his sponsors. He'd already worked on one other large international drug bust, he said, but now he wondered if he was willing to keep risking his life for cases. He was based in Southeast Asia for the moment, but was reluctant to meet me where he was living. Finally, he told me that he would be traveling in Vietnam that June. If I could be there on the half day when he had nothing planned, he would tell me whatever I wanted to know. On a broiling afternoon a month later, I stood sweating under a chandelier in the marbled lobby of a hotel just south of Hanoi's old quarter. I texted Clausen that I'd arrived, and a few minutes later he stepped out of the elevator, tall and tan at age 40, still holding on to the swimmer's build of his youth. We found an empty corner where we could order a drink and talk undisturbed. I've seen so many crazy things, I could write a book myself just about the adventures, he laughed. It was mental. We talked for the next 13 hours, shifting from the lobby to the restaurant to Clausen's room and back as he walked me through his story. We exited the hotel only to stand outside as Clausen worked his way through a pack of cigarettes. After it was all over, he told me, he'd found it impossible to return to any kind of normal life. He'd tried going home, but had trouble relating to the people he'd grown up around. You go back and you see the people you know in a local pub or whatever, and you hear the conversations these people have, he said. It's so uninteresting. People make such big dramas about nothing, about small, stupid things. That's why he'd returned to the field, as an informant, he said. He had discovered that he was good at it, and nothing else could match the feeling of bringing down evil men. The pay wasn't bad either. He had been approved for a sizable reward from the U.S. government for his work on the LaRue case, money that would secure his kids' futures. He often ruminated aloud on his own motivations, for joining LaRue's organization to begin with, and then for devoting his life to destroying it, and him. Of course, at the end of the day, I worked for a criminal, so people can call me a criminal as well, he said. Because I was aware of what he did, and I still stayed, because I wasn't breaking too many laws. The more and more I found out, the more and more I despised him. Still, he insisted, LaRue could have avoided capture and everything that followed had he just let Clausen go quietly instead of ordering him dead. I'm still angry about it. I will never forgive him that he just impulsively ordered a hit on me for no reason. That was his mistake, he said, before harking back to the phone call when he told LaRue he wouldn't hesitate to turn him in. I promised him I would take him down, and I did. As much as Clausen despised LaRue, he maintained a respect that drifted into something just sort of awe for his boss's pure intellectual brilliance. LaRue had managed a dozen different operations alone in his head. No matter how bad the guy is, no matter all the people he had killed, all the crimes he committed, no matter how people hate him, Clausen said, he's the most versatile criminal in history. What will the U.S. government do with Paul LaRue now? In my conversations with everyone from LaRue's former security team to Philippine federal agents, the talk inevitably came back to this question. Nearly everyone marveled at how easily LaRue had transformed himself into a government asset. Now he seemed poised to literally get away with murder. When he didn't see a way out, he just went into backup mode, Clausen said. He played it so smart, outsmarted everybody in the end. His value as an informant felt, in a way, manufactured. Most of the people that LaRue had helped the DEA catch had become criminals entirely at his behest. He'd given the U.S. government 3 people, including former U.S. soldiers gone rogue, who were willing to kill a DEA agent for money, and 8 more happy to import drugs into the United States. But balanced against what the DEA knew about LaRue, it was hard not to think that he had manipulated them into overlooking the gravity of his own crimes. Even the agents involved in flipping him suspected that he hadn't come entirely clean. I think his definition of what a murder is, and his culpability involved in that murder, is different than what we would determine, the former 960 Group agent told me. For him, there's this whole discernment about what he's truly responsible for. I think there's a potential Filipinos got killed, but to LaRue, if he says, handle a problem, and Dave Smith killed some Filipinos, he doesn't feel like he had them killed. I told them to handle the fucking problem. However they did it is on them. How long LaRue himself would stay in custody was anybody's guess. His fate will rest in the hands of a federal judge in the Southern District of New York, who will decide his sentence after the cases in which he provided information, including some that may not even yet be public, are resolved. At age 46, LaRue's possible futures range from life in prison to as little as 10 years under federal sentencing guidelines. Or the judge could throw the guidelines out the window and give LaRue time served. He will not be charged for any of the 7 murders he admitted to. Indeed, the government stipulated in LaRue's cooperation agreement that they lacked the jurisdiction to prosecute him for the murders anyway, although the judge is allowed to factor them into LaRue's sentence. If the case follows the path of other cooperators, a prosecutor from the Department of Justice will someday stand before a judge and argue that LaRue's cooperation entitles him to the lesser end of the sentence that his charges allow. His one request on the plane back from Liberia was that he not spend his life in prison, and he's likely to see it granted. Having already served 5 years or more, he might be back out on the street while still in his 50s. But as LaRue himself noted in his testimony, there are no guarantees. I think he'll get 15, the former 960 agent speculated. He's got 10 more to do. If and when LaRue is released, federal authorities could place him in witness protection. They could deport him, setting him adrift to find a new life or restart his old one. Technically, as part of his plea agreement, LaRue also agreed to forfeit all the proceeds of his crimes. But officially, as of the RX Limited trial, the DEA admitted to confiscating only $300,000. The Hong Kong government had clearly gotten much more. In his testimony, LaRue claimed somewhat laughably that this constituted the bulk of my assets at the time of arrest, and that his other properties and money were stolen by unknown parties. I was hard-pressed to find someone from his former organization or in the U.S. government who believed him. Bailey told me that the DEA found one bank account with $8 million in it in Mauritius, which was drained before they could seize it. By whom, they had no idea. He's betting he's going to do 10 years, and he's got millions, Bailey said. He decided, through self-preservation, that the only way I have a chance to get out of here was to cooperate. Give up the information that I can give up, do the guys that I can, hope to get out of jail with a lot of money left. Guarantee that's what he did. He sold a song. A former employee at an investment firm in Hong Kong, who contacted me after my first series of stories on LaRue, bolstered the assertion that LaRue maintained plenty of assets to start again. The firm, the employee said, had helped LaRue settle portions of his fortune into a trust in the British Virgin Islands, filtered through accounts in Gibraltar in the Netherlands. The trust listed the children from his marriage to Lillian as beneficiaries. The former employee also noted that the firm had studiously avoided inquiring as to where the money originated, and ignored red flags like the fact that LaRue never showed up in person, supplied multiple passports, and added signatories to the accounts that were clearly his own aliases. I was able to confirm the names of the trusts, but the assets remain hidden from view, and possibly from the reach of the U.S. government, should they even choose to look for them. The former employee said that tens of millions of dollars may have passed through the accounts, which LaRue accessed as recently as late 2014 or early 2015, well after he was captured by the DEA. "He's still not done, believe me," Clausen concluded. "That's the scary part. That guy is going to walk out again, and he's not done with business. The stashes that he has, still has, because I don't know what he gave up, not everything. And what they seized, it's never going to be everything. He's not that stupid." He paused and said it again. "He's not that stupid that he's going to give up everything. No." The one man who could shed the most light on LaRue's plans, LaRue himself, was still hidden away by the U.S. government. "After 2 years, I was finally able to confirm the identity of LaRue's attorney, the one who requested that the courtroom in Minnesota be closed. His name was Joseph DiBenedetto. Based in Manhattan, he was known for taking on highly publicized criminal cases, including the defense of John Gotti's brother, Peter, once accused in a plot to kill mafia hitman-turned-government informant Sammy the Bull Gravano. DiBenedetto also appeared regularly on Fox News and in other media outlets to discuss legal cases in the headlines. But in this one, he'd worked hard to keep his name out of the public eye, for reasons he didn't seem to want to discuss. He never returned any of my phone calls or emails asking him to talk about LaRue's case and explain why, in this instance, he had chosen to work anonymously. The Minnesota court did eventually unseal DiBenedetto's 2016 letter. It contained some information on LaRue's family, reporting that his first wife remained in Europe, where her safety was in jeopardy. Cindy Cayenan, according to the letter, had returned to the Philippines, but soon noticed people following her, and she and their daughter went into hiding. "Based on this information," the letter continued, "LaRue's handlers are attempting to have LaRue's family temporarily relocated to the U.S. to ensure their safety. Later, the former 960 agent told me that the relocation plan was never serious. To be quite honest with you, it was posturing on our part," he said. "He didn't care about them. He was playing a game to try and help them and help himself. And we just said, I'll take care of it, Paul." Still, the letter raised the possibility that the government might place LaRue into witness protection if and when he gets out. "I'm sure he's thinking about printing his next passports," Clausen said. "If the U.S. government helps him disappear, so much the better. For him, that's ideal. That's what he wants. For him, it's just time to plan the next thing. This time he knows the way they work. They made him smarter, a lot smarter." Plenty of LaRue's associates harbored a fear that once he was out, he would seek vengeance against them. But the man who committed the ultimate betrayal against LaRue, Felix Clausen, doubted that he would ever bother to come after him. "I'm sure if ever a day comes when he's out, and I run into him at an airport or something, he probably smiles at me and shakes my hand," he said. "That's LaRue." Others warned that they were ready to exact vengeance in the other direction, for LaRue's decision to save himself by informing on them while they kept their mouths shut. "I got loads of information. I kept a file. I've got photos. I've got fucking transcripts of emails," Marcus, the South African assassin, told me. Now that LaRue had sung to the authorities, Marcus was prepared to do the same to his former boss, if necessary. "Paul LaRue must remember one thing. If he ever comes to South Africa, or tries to, I will fucking sort him out." I often asked people if they thought LaRue's time in American custody could change him, that he could emerge chastened, maybe even ready to commit his technical brilliance to a positive cause. "I really doubt it," his cousin Matthew Smith said. "He loved what he did and wouldn't give it up. I think it was fun for him. I think he really wanted to be the biggest thing. He wanted the infamy. He told me a few times that when he gets caught, he'll be on CNN. What LaRue wanted and why is a subject I puzzled over for years. For some, the answer was obvious, money. He was corrupted by it, enamored with it, addicted to the feeling of it flowing toward him, more than he could ever spend. There were naturally those who diagnosed something more fundamental to his nature. He was a complete sociopath, said the Israeli who had briefly handled the job of procuring women for LaRue. You look at the definition of sociopath, inability for empathy and so on, this is him, word for word. My own reporting had revealed him to be, at the least, a monster who never thought twice about ordering the maiming and killing of people around him. There were times when he came off as a sadist who reveled in it. Some people speculated that his drive was fueled by some submerged pain, his hurt over being adopted, or some other childhood affront for which he was forever exacting revenge on the world. Maybe so. I always suspected that at least part of the answer dwelled in his life as a programmer. LaRue had found his place inside code, a universe in which he could bend reality to his will. It seemed to me that he tried to apply the detached logic of software to real life. That's why the DEA schemes must have appealed to him. Nothing involves emotion for him, the former 960 agent put it to me. Everything is a calculation. His approach was algorithmic, not moral. Set the program in motion and watch it run. One afternoon in Tel Aviv, I met a former employee of LaRue's at a bustling cafe. I'd had a difficult time persuading him to talk to me at all. He was finally free of LaRue's organization and had moved on with his life, he said. He hadn't been indicted in any of the cases, despite working for both the pharmaceutical and mercenary sides of LaRue's business, although he said he planned to wait a few years before traveling to the United States, just in case. After days of deflecting my inquiries, he finally relented and agreed to talk to me anonymously about his time with LaRue, and to confirm what I had heard from others. We spoke for an hour, and as we stood up to leave, I asked him the question, what did LaRue want? He wanted to be the biggest ever caught, he said. Then he leaned in, pointing at my notebook. If you publish this story, ultimately you are giving him what he wanted. And by talking to you, I guess I am too. This is what he wanted. This story to be told in this way. Epilogue. 2017 to 2018. Justice for Catherine Lee. LaRue spills all. Scattered to the winds. On my first trip to the Philippines, in late 2015, I happened to arrive in the middle of a presidential campaign. An outsider candidate named Rodrigo Duterte, the mayor of Davao, a city of 1.5 million people on the volatile southern island of Mindanao, was running on a pledge to institute a massive crackdown on drugs and crime. All of you who are into drugs, you sons of bitches, I will really kill you, he said in the course of campaigning. If elected, he pledged to kill 100,000 drug dealers, dumping so many bodies into Manila Bay that, as he put it, the fish will grow fat. He was running behind several other candidates at the time, and as with then-candidate Donald Trump in the United States, nobody I talked to seemed to take him seriously. An establishment candidate and close ally of Benigno Aquino, the president at the time, was widely expected to win. By my last trip to Manila in mid-2017, Duterte had been president for a year, and had wasted no time making good on his promise. Police and unidentified gunmen had killed more than 7,000 suspected drug users, drug dealers, and seemingly random targets in the streets. International human rights groups were shocked by the extrajudicial slaughter, but Duterte was unapologetic. He claimed to hold a list of other names, containing as many as a million people, who were involved in the drug trade in the Philippines. The human rights people will commit suicide if I finish these all, he said. In fact, he'd taken to bragging that as mayor, he'd personally killed a few suspected criminals himself. Duterte's twisted bravado put me in mind of LaRue, and how he'd fired a few extra bullets into Dave Smith, almost as if he wanted to claim he had done some of the killing himself. I wondered how much he and his operation contributed to the climate that brought Duterte to power. Not that LaRue himself ever made a significant public impression in the Philippines, having never been prosecuted for his crimes. But that was precisely the point. The scope of corruption and lawlessness that LaRue generated and exploited was certainly enough to leave ordinary citizens cynical about their government. I wondered, too, how LaRue would have fared had he stuck around for the state-sponsored violence of the Duterte regime. One source connected to the Manila underworld told me he'd talked to people in the higher levels of the cartels now active in the country, who said that the killing campaign was targeted only at addicts and low-level dealers, leaving the higher-ups, who knew how to pay for protection, untouched. The drug business, he said, was booming. They said, we're sending in more, they're stockpiling it, the source told me. So you killed how many thousands of people? There's no dent in it. The former 960 agent agreed. He and Paul would do business together, guarantee you, he said of Duterte. Paul would have to pay bribes. It would be fine. When I went back to see Rizaldi Rivera at the National Bureau of Investigation on one of my last days in Manila, I asked him if there was any chance LaRue could be extradited to face the consequences of his crimes here. Well, if ever there is a move to extradite Paul LaRue, it will probably come from the MBI, he said. The problem is, do you think the U.S. government will allow that? They will object to that, because LaRue is a prize catch. Rivera had transferred out of the Death Investigation Division and moved downstairs to environmental crimes. When Aurora Almendral and I showed up for our lunchtime appointment, we found five guys in the division's office eating pizza and watching daytime talk shows on a small television. While we waited, I noticed a printed-out sign in English taped to a nearby wall. "Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the righteous." When Rivera finally arrived, in a purple button-down and jeans, I wondered if he'd been exiled to a bureau backwater, but he told me he preferred environmental crimes to his old gig. "There's so much pressure in the high-profile cases at DID," he said. Even with the transfer, he'd continued helping the DEA with the Catherine Lee murder case, despite the fact that they hadn't reciprocated with any documents that would help Rivera build an indictment in the Philippines. Together, they'd made progress gathering more evidence against Adam Samia and David Stillwell, the North Carolina men facing trial in New York for Lee's killing. But he had bigger news to relay. "We recovered the vehicle," he told me.
"You did?"
"Yeah, it is here. It is in my custody." In February 2017, LaRue had finally provided the DEA with the whereabouts of the Toyota Innova van. It was sitting in a garage at a house he still owned in the gated suburb of Las Piñas. The authorities, he said, could pick it up from the house's caretaker. Two DEA agents had flown to Manila and driven out to retrieve it. The agents wanted to deliver the van to the U.S. Embassy. "But I object it, with due respect," Rivera said. I said, "I think the legal chain of custody will be broken." Instead, the van was brought to the MBI for safekeeping. "Do you want to see it?" he said. I did. We walked out to a parking lot in the interior of the complex, hemmed in by buildings on all sides. The van looked to be in good shape. Peering inside, Rivera pointed out that the middle seat had been removed, and on the floor, under piles of empty water bottles and fast food wrappers, was a large dark stain. "You can plainly see what appears to be bloodstains," Rivera said. "But I still don't know if those are really bloodstains, and if they are bloodstains, are they from animals or human?" The U.S. authorities had proposed a series of plans to conduct forensic analysis on the van, including sending an FBI team to Manila or shipping the entire vehicle to Quantico, Virginia. Rivera said the plans, which required the approval of the Ministry of Justice in the Philippines, never materialized. Later, U.S. authorities would say that the MBI simply refused to let them have the van. Since the Philippine authorities lacked the equipment to test potentially 5-year-old stains, they wouldn't be able to confirm if what I saw was blood from Catherine Lee. But there was another way prosecutors might at least put Samia and Stillwell at the scene of the crime. When they searched Samia's house after his arrest, they found what looked to be the key to a Toyota van, just like the one now sitting in the MBI parking lot. Rivera told me that DEA agents were returning to Manila with the key to test it out. A few weeks later, after I was back in the U.S., Rivera sent me a text. The van had started. The prosecution of Samia, Stillwell, and Hunter for the murder of Catherine Lee would offer the U.S. government another chance to make good on the deal they had cut with LaRue. The trial was finally set for April 2018 in Manhattan, and the prosecution's filings indicated that unlike in the Minnesota cases, their star witness would be Paul LaRue himself. The trial took place inside the white-columned edifice flanking Manhattan's Foley Square, in a courtroom with vaulted ceilings and seating for more than 100 spectators. The first morning of jury selection, I sat in the gallery a few rows behind the prosecutor's table, where three assistant U.S. attorneys from the Southern District Office waited alongside Eric Stouch, from the DEA's 960 group. The three defendants entered under escort by federal marshals. Adam Samia, with his slicked back hair and self-assured smirk, seemed at times to be almost mocking the proceedings. David Stillwell, who had already confessed to being present at the murder as the driver, looked shell-shocked. Stillwell's attorney had already signaled in pretrial filings that his defense consisted almost entirely of a procedural question over whether he'd known the job included murder before departing for the Philippines. The federal murder conspiracy statute, under which the three men were prosecuted, required that they knowingly entered into the conspiracy while inside the United States. Simply murdering someone overseas is not, as it happens, illegal in the States. Joseph Hunter was the most inscrutable of the three. Still an intimidating barrel of a man, he now walked with a cane, and his affect was one of morose resignation. The only question in this trial for him was whether his 20 years in prison would be extended to life. As U.S. District Judge Ronnie Abrams walked the potential jurors through a series of questions to ferret out their biases, The courtroom echoed with the names and places that had once filled the post-its stuck to my apartment wall. Jury candidates were asked if they were familiar with the cast of characters that spanned the breadth of LaRue's operation. Tim Vanvakias, Nestor Del Rosario, Shai Reuven, Lachlan McConnell, Matthew Smith, Moran Oz, Bruce Jones, John Nash, and others. They were asked if they were familiar with locations from North Korea to Zambia, Papua New Guinea to the Seychelles, Roxboro, North Carolina, to Taytay in the Philippines. Catherine Lee's death would be the fulcrum upon which prosecutors would balance Paul LaRue's story, because it would be LaRue, not the defendants, who would dominate the trial. With a 12-member jury in place, consisting of 10 women and 2 men, Assistant U.S. Attorney Patrick Egan stood up to deliver his opening remarks. On February 4, 2012, Catherine Lee was riding in the backseat of a van, he began. With her were 2 men she barely knew, Samia and Stillwell, who had contacted her under the guise of seeking real estate and now intended to murder her. But the story, the prosecutor said, started long before Catherine Lee got into the van that night. The narrative that Egan wove together began with Samia, an old friend of Dave Smith's, working alongside Hunter at Echelon, a front group for LaRue's mercenary teams. For years, Egan said, Samia had been asking Smith and Hunter for wet work, assassination missions. In 2011, after LaRue murdered Smith and elevated Hunter to head the kill teams, Samia's opportunity finally came. He in turn recruited his buddy Stillwell, a weekend warrior type who often falsely told people he'd worked as a military sniper. And the two of them, directed by Hunter, flew to the Philippines for a salary of $10,000 a month plus $25,000 in bonus money for each job. These guys had one purpose, to murder, Egan said. He described the van they'd done it in, and the key found in Samia's house. He told the jurors that they would see video of Hunter, from the DEA's sting operation, describing the murder in detail. And then you will hear from Paul LaRue, he concluded. He will tell you in his own words how his criminal organization worked. The defense attorney's openings consisted primarily of reminders to the jury that the government had to prove their allegations beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, Mr. Egan was pretty dramatic, wasn't he? Samia's attorney quipped. His drama is not evidence. To me, their task seemed Herculean. Stillwell had confessed and pointed to Samia as the trigger man. Hunter was caught on tape virtually confessing his own role. And with photos of a bloody head recovered from his laptop and the van key from his house, Samia faced a seemingly insurmountable collection of circumstantial evidence. Not to mention that the government planned to present LaRue as the mastermind who had arranged it all, and now could condemn all 3 men to their fates. Before we got to that, the prosecutors laid out the gruesome details of Lee's death, the same ones that I had found in the police file 3 years earlier. She had died immediately, the doctor who conducted the autopsy testified, from 2 gunshot wounds, 1 below each eye, that left 22 caliber slugs lodged in her brain. On day 2, a juror wrote a note to the judge declaring that she feared for her safety. Judge Abrams replaced her and the trial carried on. I was surprised that she was the only one. The prosecution called a DEA technician in Thailand to establish the validity of the surveillance video of Hunter in Phuket, and then began playing snippets of him describing the murder plan and how Samia and Stillwell had botched it. An expert in electronic evidence explained how they'd recovered files, emails, and photos off of Samia's and Stillwell's digital devices. Then the prosecution began methodically introducing years' worth of emails between Samia and Hunter, Samia and Dave Smith, Hunter and LaRue. The main event began midway on the second day, when another prosecutor, Emil Beauvais, stood and called LaRue to the stand. He entered from a door behind and to the right of the judge, in a dark blue, short-sleeved prison uniform. He'd maintained his bulk since the hearing 2 years before, in Minnesota, but his face seemed thinner. His gait was labored as he walked across the courtroom to the witness stand, unshackled but escorted by a U.S. Marshal. He pulled out a pair of glasses from a small case in his breast pocket, put them on, and gazed out over the courtroom. If it was infamy he'd been seeking, as his cousin once suggested to me, the smattering of spectators, a few reporters, Thomas Sindrick, and several fellow agents from the 960 group, suggested that he hadn't quite found it. I watched him closely and was certain I saw a small smirk pass across his face when his eyes rested on Joseph Hunter, glaring at him from the defendant's table. Beauvais quickly established that LaRue was now 45 years old, born in Zimbabwe and raised partly in South Africa, and that he had once employed both Hunter and Samia as mercenaries. Then he turned immediately to the matter at hand. "Do you know of a woman named Catherine Lee?" he asked LaRue. "Yes, I do," LaRue said. "Who is Catherine Lee?" "Catherine Lee was a real estate broker in the Philippines." "Sir, where is Catherine Lee today?" "I had her killed." "Why?" "I believe that she was involved in stealing money from me." "How do you know that Catherine Lee was murdered?" "I was told she was killed by Joseph Hunter." LaRue paused to correct himself. "Sorry. What I mean is, I was told by Joseph Hunter that she had been killed." "Did Hunter tell you who participated in the murder?" "Yes. Joseph Hunter told me that the kill team, consisting of Adam Samia and his partner, were the ones that killed Catherine Lee." For the next 2 days, through his deliberately precise answers, LaRue recounted many of the same facts that I had spent years prying from the hard-to-find and the reluctant. He claimed that he had made $300 million in his illegal online pharmacy business, employing between 1,000 and 2,000 people, and then laundered it through gold, diamonds, and timber in Africa and Asia. He detailed how, in 2005, he met Dave Smith, who gave him an entry into the world of mercenaries. At times he seemed to have been overprepared by the prosecutors, mechanically repeating practice sentences about how his quote-unquote echelon mercenaries, referring to the front company sometimes used to hire Smith's men, were employed solely to, quote, intimidate, shoot, threaten, and or kill their targets. LaRue offered basic details on almost every one of his ventures. "I set up a front company in Somalia, which pretended to be about a fishing operation, but was actually a front for criminal activity," he said. "My objective in Somalia was to obtain a small territory and set myself up as a warlord, using whatever violence was necessary." He'd canceled the project, he said, when he came to believe that the manager was stealing from him. LaRue provided his own version of one of the most outlandish stories I'd heard, the planned invasion and coup in the Seychelles. I'd long suspected the story was one of those rumors that spread among mercenaries, embellished each time it was passed along. LaRue, instead, confirmed its veracity. Dave Smith, LaRue said, had introduced LaRue to someone who purported to be related to the current ruler of the country, but wanted him deposed. If LaRue could provide the force to do it, he'd receive both a safe haven in the Seychelles and a diplomatic passport in return. He had entertained the coup plan seriously enough to send Joseph Hunter to the island nation to investigate it. "What did he report?" Beauvais asked LaRue. "Hunter reported that approximately 30 mercenaries would be required, 30 echelon mercenaries," LaRue said. "Required for what?" "To take over the government, basically to defeat any resistance in the Seychelles and take over the government." In the end, LaRue said, he told Smith the mission wasn't viable in the long term. Sure, Smith's mercenaries could overrun the country, but the current government's allies across the water in Tanzania would inevitably mobilize their much more serious military to come take it back. LaRue was dispassionate about the violence he'd ordered. Yes, he had ordered drugs planted on Andrew Hahn, one of the brothers from Zimbabwe who he believed had stolen over $1 million from him. Yes, he had sent Joseph Hunter and Chris DeMeyer to firebomb his cousin Matthew's house. Yes, he had ordered Smith to intimidate Moran Oz, an order Smith had carried out with Hunter and DeMeyer by throwing Oz off a boat and shooting at him. On LaRue's orders, DeMeyer had also thrown a hand grenade at a real estate broker's house. Not Catherine Lee nor Noemi Edelor, but a third one. "Why did you target this other person?" the prosecutor asked. "That other person owed me approximately $1,000, he said. LaRue did clear up one lingering mystery for me, around John Nash, the man who had been among the last to see both Bruce Jones and his attorney, Joe Frank Zuniga, alive. Nash, LaRue testified, had once sold LaRue fake weapons and cocaine. LaRue said that he had hired Nash to kill Zuniga, in exchange for a partial forgiveness of his debt. When he arrived at the details of the Lee murder, Beauvais spent hours projecting emails up on the screen. He guided LaRue through the plans for Samia and Stillwell, who had reported back to him at the time through emails from Hunter. When the cross-examination began, LaRue transformed completely, from the helpful witness to the intransigent, reluctant verbal combatant. "Could you break down that question into smaller parts?" he responded to a two-part question. "It's not precise," he complained about other questions. "I'm not sure what you mean by intelligent," he said, when asked whether he considered himself such. Much of his resistance relied on extreme literalism. When shown a copy of his own cooperation agreement, including his signature, he quibbled that he was seeing only a photocopy of my signature. I'm not saying I doubt it's the agreement, he said. I just can't be certain that the text matches the agreement I have. At times he projected the air of a CEO being asked to answer for the actions of a sprawling corporation. I already testified there were 2,000 people who were employed, he said in response to a question about insulating himself from culpability. There was no design regarding who I met and who I didn't meet. Anyone was able to come and speak to me at any time. My door was always open. The defense attempted to portray LaRue as both a monster and a man who would say anything to get out of prison. Samia's attorney spent the first portion of his cross-examination goading LaRue to admit that the password to his laptop, when he was arrested in Liberia, had been Hitler. But establishing that LaRue lacked remorse was easy enough. Fair to say that you were planning on murdering anyone that you had determined had double-crossed you? Hunter's attorney asked. That's fair to say, yes, LaRue said. Later, Samia's attorney picked up the same line of questioning. After you killed the first person, did you ever feel bad about it? He asked. I felt bad about the victims, yes. It didn't stop you from killing the next one, or the next one, or the next one, did it? LaRue paused before responding. It did not. He admitted that at the time he was committing the crimes, he was unconcerned about the consequences in the Philippines. I didn't care who knew what, whether people knew the crimes were happening or not, because I had the police on the payroll, he said. I was protected. The bulk of the cross-examination, by three different attorneys, was spent on LaRue's decision to cooperate. He appeared well-practiced in his answers concerning his agreement with the government. The crimes to which he had pleaded guilty carried a sentence of 10 years to life, he said, but he would never be prosecuted for most of what he'd done, from violence to drug dealing. And if he told the truth and provided substantial assistance, they could choose to write his judge a so-called 5K1 letter, named after a clause in federal sentencing guidelines, asking for a reduced sentence. If they did, the judge could venture below the minimum and even give him time served. But they weren't required to, LaRue noted again and again. The government has not made me any promises, he said. But you are hoping that when you are sentenced, you will receive a sentence of time served, right? Hunter's attorney asked. I'm hoping that when I eventually am sentenced, I will receive a decent sentence, was all LaRue would allow. I don't know whether I've done enough to warrant a time-served sentence, given the horrific nature of my criminal activity, he added, with a tone that sounded more world-weary than contrite. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf. And after any of the murders you were involved in, did you think about turning over a new leaf after any of those? Adam Samia's attorney asked him. I would have to say no, LaRue said. Samia's attorney took the time to highlight the glaring contrast between his statements in court and the vigilante justice LaRue had carried out against the likes of Bruce Jones and Joe Frank Zuniga. So you thought that the punishment for cooperation should be death, right? He asked. Yes. Well, do you believe that you should be killed for cooperating? No. What makes you different than Mr. Jones? Nothing. After LaRue, the prosecution called Tim Vambakias, the former American soldier who was already serving a 20-year sentence for his role in the scheme to kill a DEA agent. He recounted much of what he'd told me by email, from his recruitment to LaRue's hit team by his friend Hunter, whom he called White Kong in emails, to the ninja work they had both signed on for. The defense attorneys attempted to chip away at his credibility, forcing him to repeat over and over that he was testifying only for the chance of getting his sentence reduced. Adam Samia was the only defendant to take the stand. When his attorney kicked off his testimony by asking Samia if he had killed Catherine Lee, he leaned into the microphone and said loudly, "Absolutely not." He then spun an implausible story. Rather than surveilling and killing Lee, as the photos on his and Stillwell's phone and laptop seemed to indicate, he had spent the early months of 2012 in the Philippines driving LaRue's employees back and forth to the airport. The money he'd wired back from the Philippines wasn't payment for the murder, but winnings from a mixed martial arts fight. Ultimately, the jury wasn't swayed. After only a few hours of deliberation, they returned with guilty verdicts for all three defendants. The mandatory sentence for their charges is life without parole. Barring a successful appeal, Hunter, Samia, and Stillwell will almost certainly spend their remaining lives in federal prison. The end of the trial in April 2018 paved the way for LaRue to be sentenced, although no one seemed to know when that would happen. Buried in the hours of testimony in the Lee murder trial, there was one clue to LaRue's plans if and when he was released. LaRue admitted that while in custody in the summer of 2016, he'd broken the jail's rules and contacted an inmate named Mir Islam at another facility in the United States. LaRue had met Islam in custody the year prior, when they were housed together, and before he'd been transferred to another prison, Islam had told LaRue he was soon to be released. LaRue coaxed a paralegal into setting up a series of calls with Islam. During these three-way calls, did you make any plans with Mir Islam? The prosecutor asked LaRue. I discussed opening a call center business, LaRue said. I was going to fund it. The other defendants prosecuted in the Southern District for the drug and murder stings were assigned to federal prisons around the country. Tim Benvakias and Dennis Gogol, having pleaded guilty to conspiring to murder a federal agent, received the same sentence Hunter had originally, 20 years apiece. Benvakias presumably will receive a reduction in his sentence for cooperating, or even witness protection, but his information has now been purged from the Bureau of Prisons' public database. Michael Filter got 8 years for surveillance on the cocaine deal, while Slawomir Szaborski received 9 on the same charge. Lengths of sentences in federal drug cases are tied to the amount of drugs in question, even if, as in this case, those drugs were fictitious. In the North Korean meth case, Adrian Valkovic, the ground commander, was sentenced to more than 9 years for offering to provide security for the transaction. Kelly Peralta, the middleman on the deal, received a 7.5-year sentence. Yi Tiong Tan Lim went down for 11.5 years. Large portions of Philip Shackle's sentencing hearing were redacted by the government, including almost all of the testimony of his father, a former Irish intelligence officer, for unexplained reasons. Shackle's received 7 years, with the possibility of a transfer to an Irish prison. Scott Stammers, who the government claimed had been a leader in the plan, was sentenced to 15 years. In Hong Kong, Doran Shulman, who managed LaRue's gold stores and imported the ammonium nitrate, pleaded guilty to 2 counts of money laundering and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. The other Israelis claimed, without success, to have been ignorant of the source of the gold. Yoav Hen and Daniel Fadlan ultimately pleaded guilty to money laundering and were sentenced to 4 years in prison. Omer Gavish fought the charges but was convicted and received 5.5 years. All of them were released early and returned to Israel. Through an intermediary, they declined to speak with me. In July 2014, the U.S. government finally declared tramadol, the generic version of Ultram, a Schedule 4 controlled substance. All three of the painkillers favored by LaRue's networks are now controlled drugs under U.S. law. In 2013, UPS paid $40 million to resolve federal accusations of knowingly shipping drugs for illegal online pharmacies. A year later, after refusing a similar deal, FedEx was indicted by a federal grand jury in San Francisco for conspiracy to traffic in controlled substances on behalf of illegal internet pharmacies. RX Limited was not among the pharmacy networks included, but the former DEA agent in the 960 group told me that LaRue provided information to the prosecutors in the case. In the middle of a trial that began 2 years later, when FedEx alleged that DEA agents had failed to inform FedEx representatives that they should stop shipping the drugs, prosecutors suddenly dropped all the charges. In 2017, Kent Bailey retired from the DEA after 3 decades as an agent. 2 weeks later, he started a job as a Minnesota State Coordinator for the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program, facilitating collaboration between law enforcement agencies. Kimberly Brill was promoted to Group Supervisor for the Diversion Control Division of the Minneapolis office. Stephen Holdren is an agent at the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development in Minneapolis. Eric Stouch remains at the DEA's Special Operations Division. Thomas Sindrick retired, taking a job with an organization combating ivory poaching. Derek Maltz also departed the DEA. Like a number of other ex-SOD agents from the LaRue case, he entered the private sector, joining PenLink, a software provider for communication surveillance collection and analysis. In Brazil, Zion Fadlan became the co-owner of the successful Discovery Hostel and Restaurant in Rio. He was never charged with any crimes related to Paul LaRue. When I traveled there in late 2017, I was unable to locate the women with whom LaRue had attempted to conceive children. John Wall, after taking a plea deal that could have resulted in up to 5 years in prison, was sentenced to probation in 2017. As of the trial, he was working as a dispatcher for a concrete company. Moran Oz returned to Israel, where he ignored requests for additional interviews. Alon Berkman remained in hiding, as he had since he was indicted in the United States in 2014. When I reached out to his family in 2016, they claimed to have no way of contacting him. Gone, too, was Omer Bezalel since jumping bail in Minnesota. One source told me he was living openly in Israel, but couldn't put me in touch. After his acquittal, Lachlan McConnell returned to Canada. When I last spoke to him, he declined to disclose his location and said he was considering returning to the Philippines. Nestor Del Rosario went into hiding. After years of searching for him and hearing speculation that he was likely dead, I finally found a former LaRue employee who was in touch with him. She passed along a message, but he never responded. Prabhakara Tempati lives with his family in Pennsylvania and runs three successful sleep and obesity treatment clinics across the Northeast. He maintains an interest in pursuing telemedicine. By 2025, the global telemedicine market is expected to reach $80 billion. After his guilty plea, Charles Schultz sold Schultz Pharmacy and shuttered Medicine Mart. He died in 2018 at the age of 86. Paul LaRue's girlfriend, Cindy Kayanen, was never indicted or arrested by the U.S. government and appears to run an investment firm out of one of Paul LaRue's old offices. Lillian Cheng Yen Pui and LaRue were formally divorced in June 2013. According to the letter from LaRue's lawyer in 2016, the United States was considering relocating her and her family from their home in Europe for their safety. I was unable to confirm the existence of his other rumored children in the Philippines. LaRue's cousin Matthew Smith lives in Bulawayo, where he remains in contact with Steve and Andrew Han, the latter of whom was eventually released from Philippine custody after 2 years on false drug charges, trumped up by LaRue and Dave Smith. John Nash, as of this writing, remains in the limbo of Philippine immigration custody. In the summer of 2017, Aurora Almendral and I talked our way in to visit him at Baikutan, a wretched open-air detention center housed on a military base in Manila. Nash had been held there for nearly 3 years without charges, and when he entered the waiting room, he seemed nervous and frail. "I wish you'd come earlier," he said. "I read your stories. I follow you on Twitter." He admitted to working for LaRue, but denied, unconvincingly, to my ear, based on what LaRue had told authorities, involvement in the deaths of Bruce Jones and Joe Frank Zuniga. The Blue Rock Resort in Barreto continues to be a hub of intrigue. In April 2013, a man walked up to a table, pulled out a .45, and shot the bar's owner in the back of the head, execution style. The crime has not been solved. In 2014, the captain who took over for Bruce Jones on the MV Ufuk, John Byrne, became the only person convicted in the arms smuggling case. Byrne had long since jumped bail and fled the country, but he was sentenced to an 8-year prison term in absentia. In 2016, the Ufuk sank under mysterious circumstances in Manila Bay. LaRue's superfast yacht, the Texas Star II, after being confiscated by the DEA, was reused in a dramatic operation to capture a prominent Guinea-Bissau drug kingpin off the coast of West Africa. Mechanical problems on board the boat delayed the operation by a month. Afterward, the agency put it up for sale. Marcus, LaRue's hitman, continues to live freely in South Africa. "Fuck, I've already said so much. The last thing I want is people knocking on my door," he said to me after we'd talked for an hour. "I'll never be able to put my fucking feet in America, or they will lock me up, I suppose." He felt he'd paid for the killings in his own way. "I think karma sorted me out for the shit I've done. I got divorced, I lost everything, I had to restart. I rebuilt my life, a good job and everything, and now I'm a bit scared because I don't know what's going to happen, to be quite honest." He was disappointed, he said, that he'd never get to take the Harley road trip across the southern United States that he'd always dreamed about. After bringing down LaRue, Felix Claussen moved to Southeast Asia. In 2014, an international sustainable fisheries organization proposed that Somalia redevelop its fishing industry, including small-scale fish processing plants, strikingly similar to the one Paul LaRue had envisioned. As of this writing, Paul Calder LaRue remains in federal custody in New York City, awaiting sentencing. The last time I saw LaRue was in the fall of 2018, in a small courtroom on the 12th floor of a federal courthouse in Manhattan. The hearing, the first in LaRue's own case that wasn't sealed from the public, had been called to assign him new representation. He'd told the court he was finished with Joseph DiBenedetto and ready to accept free court-appointed counsel instead. I wondered if that meant that he'd run out of easily accessible cash. Or perhaps he saw no need to spend any more of it, given how little lawyering was left to be done on his behalf. The most important factor in his sentencing would be the 5K1 letter from prosecutors, outlining the assistance he had provided. His prospective attorney, a local criminal defender assigned to the case named Xavier Donaldson, walked in half an hour late and had yet to be informed of LaRue's charges, or even his name. The lead prosecutor, Michael Lockhart, stepped up to summarize LaRue's situation for the judge. Mr. LaRue has pleaded guilty in this case and has assisted law enforcement by, among other things, testifying in a trial, he said. The court was alerted, and we were alerted, to some issues between Mr. LaRue and his attorney. In an aside to Donaldson, he characterized the issues as a breakdown in attorney-client communications. LaRue's cooperation with the government was now complete, Lockhart continued, and the last of the defendants he'd testified against, Joseph Hunter, would be sentenced in the new year. The judge could sentence him as soon as the spring. Sitting only a few feet away from me, LaRue looked smaller up close, enveloped by his blue jail scrubs. He sat with his shoulders hunched at the defense table, polite and subdued in his answers to the judge's questions. He asked for time to confer with Donaldson before completing the switch. The judge adjourned for 2 weeks to allow him to do so. I appreciate it so much, believe me, I heard him say to Donaldson as he stood up. Two U.S. Marshals moved in to stand guard as he plodded out of the courtroom, glancing periodically over their shoulders to assess possible threats to the U.S. government's once-prized asset. When I looked around the rows of the gallery, though, it was empty, except for me. This is Evan Ratliff. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Mastermind, Drugs, Empire, Murder, Betrayal. This program was directed by Lewis Milgram, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2019 by Evan Ratliff. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.